to order the Senate Special Committee on Budget, the Public Safety Subcommittee for Tuesday, June 7th, 2005. This is an informational meeting with the Oregon Youth Authority to hear a report from the Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee. And I would like to invite forward Mr. Bob Jester, Mr. Phil Lemon, and Mr. Rod Brown, that is Chief Brown, to help us walk through your report.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with permission, I would like to also ask Julie McFarland, a member of the Safety Committee, if she would join us at the table.
That is quite appropriate. Please come forward if we can find a chair that dislodges from me. Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Jester, where I would like to begin this afternoon, a couple of weeks ago asked you for a brief summary of the issues regarding the criminal prosecution of Michael Lee Boyles and actions of the Oregon Youth Authority, actions taken in response to that, and you responded with a letter to me detailing the actions that OYA has taken to date, and it would be helpful, I believe, to get your response to my request on the record, if we can do that as a part of your presentation. And then the other thing that we are taking up, of course, is a report from the review committee that was formed in response to the indictment of Mr. Boyles, a former OYA parole and probation officer, for felony sex offenses related to youth on his caseload. Are you able to begin in that way?
Madam Chair, we are locating a copy of the letter that I sent to you. I have it in front of me.
You do? Okay.
The letter is sent and dated May 31st, 2005. It is to the Honorable Ava Gordley, State Senator. Dear Senator Gordley, you asked for a brief summary of issues regarding the criminal prosecution of Michael Lee Boyles and the action the Oregon Youth Authority has taken in response. Please let me know if you need additional information. Michael Boyles is a former Oregon Youth Authority juvenile parole and probation officer who is facing state and federal criminal charges for allegedly sexually abusing youth on his caseload. Related criminal charges have also been filed against a former OYA foster parent. Mr. Boyles is scheduled to be tried on those charges in June. The Oregonian has reported that relatives of one of the youth offenders expressed concern about possible sexual abuse by Mr. Boyles to juvenile corrections officials, and the state did not follow through with promised actions regarding those concerns. While OYA has been able to verify, has not been able to verify those complaints, we have taken a series of actions to respond to issues raised by the Boyles case and to review agencies' responses to this information. Among the actions OYA has taken, we have appointed a group of public safety and child welfare officials to review circumstances relating to this case and make recommendations on additional actions OYA should take to minimize the possibility that this might happen again. The review committee will provide a written status report to legislative leadership on June the 1st, followed by presentations to the House and Senate Public Safety Budget Committees. Responded to legislator concerns by answering a series of questions posed by Senator Winters, providing testimony in OIA budget hearings, and meeting individually with concerned legislators. Ordered an internal audit of the OIA foster care program to identify recommended changes in the agency program management to control risk. Expanded requirements for criminal history checks, certification standards, and on-site inspections of foster homes. Modified agencies' rules and policies regarding appropriate relationships with youth offenders, professional boundaries, and conduct. Directed that every Oregon Youth Authority employee receive refresher training on their duties as mandatory reporters of child abuse. As I have told you and other legislators, I and the 1,100 employees of the Oregon Youth Authority regret the actions our agency took were not sufficient to protect the victims from harm it appears they have suffered. We are deeply troubled that Juvenile Corrections has joined the number of professionals that face allegations of pedophiles in their ranks. We continue our commitment to protecting public safety, protecting the youth in our custody, and to providing meaningful reformation opportunities for youth offenders. We realize that despite our many accomplishments and the pride we have in our work, the tragic results of this case have diminished the trust and confidence in the Oregon Youth Authority. We will continue to restore that confidence. If you or other legislators have any questions, please contact me or Deputy Director Phil Lemon at 373-7212. Sincerely, Robert Jester, Director, Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jester, for making that correspondence a part of the record. What I would like to do next is turn to the preliminary report from the Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee, chaired by Chief Brown. Chief, thank you very much for being present today, and also thank you for your willingness to take on this responsibility and charge. And I note that you write in your letter dated June 1st, 2005, your letter to the Honorable Peter Courtney, President of the Senate, the Honorable Karen Minnis, Speaker of the House, this chair, the Honorable Avell Gordley, and the Honorable Dennis Richardson, Chair of the House Budget Subcommittee on Human Services and Public Safety, and to Mr. Jester, you indicate that the charge of the committee, and I'm reading directly from page 2 of your letter, was to review the circumstances related to alleged sexual abuse of youth offenders under the supervision a former OYA juvenile parole and probation officer Michael Boyles and or placed in the James Lyman Foster Home and make recommendations to minimize the possibility of abuse of youth offenders in OYA custody. The committee has made significant progress toward our responsibilities, you wrote, and this status report identifies what has been accomplished thus far, what still remains to be done, and partial recommendations conditioned on the completion of our work. And Chief Brown, what we would like to do is have you walk us through what has been identified in your preliminary work, what does remain to be done, and what we might expect from that review. And I'd also like to, at this time, acknowledge that Senator Carter is present and invite Senator Carter forward to participate with the panel. Senator Shields has been extended to him. He'll be with us for a short time. We also expect that Senator Burdick and Senator Walker, possibly Senator Ringel, will also join us during this meeting, and there may be others that I'm aware of. Senator Winters will not be with us this afternoon. Chief, please go forward.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, Senator Carter, thank you very much. My name is Rod Brown, and I am the President and Chief Executive Officer of Public Safety Liability Management Incorporated, a risk management firm specializing in issues of public safety agency risk exposure. I'm also a retired Chief of Police. I have been asked to serve as the chair of the Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee. The committee was formed at the request of Robert Jester, director of the Oregon Youth Authority, near the beginning of May. We have had about 30 days to accomplish what has been done thus far and to issue the interim status report. The committee was given 3 specific charges and asked to respond to 9 separate questions, which were detailed in the status report delivered on June 1st. The committee's review thus far has focused on 9 different areas, including policies, training, personnel practices, early warning systems, supervision of personnel, accountability of employees, investigative practices of complaints made against employees, potential oversight of complaint handling and disposition, and proactive responses to critical incidents. We have additionally considered and are still seeking information regarding the culture within the organization and what effect, if any, it may have had in the recognition or lack thereof of incidents or situations that may have raised an inquiry that something improper was happening. The first and foremost concern of this committee is the protection of youth. With that priority in mind, the committee is working to fully identify all of the issues and circumstances that may have allowed the alleged abuses by Michael Boyles or any other similar instance to occur. Committee members have worked very hard to read, digest, and analyze a tremendous amount of information thus far. Interviews have also been conducted, and there will be even more individuals contacted, including some youth, who may be able to provide us with additional information which will add to our knowledge and understanding of the circumstances. In the status report you have, our early recommendations have focused on five areas. These areas represent a chronology of steps wherein a weakness in the system or process will allow the hiring and retention of an employee that could abuse their position and or youth in their care. These areas include hiring, and within that hiring process, we're looking at the initial screening and testing of employees or applicants, the background investigations, and psychological testing to determine fitness for that duty. The second area is training, which includes initial entry-level training, in-service or continuing, and supervisory and management training. Third area is handling of complaints against employees, and in that recommendation, we are suggesting a dedicated position within the Oregon Youth Authority reporting to either employee services or the director himself that would handle investigations of complaints against the organization or any of its employees. The fourth is the oversight and accountability of the complaint handling process. And within that, we are suggesting an external, possibly an ombudsman for the overall oversight and accountability auditing of the complaint process within the organization. And lastly, the agency's policies itself. There are numerous other areas the committee is reviewing and considering for recommendations. These other areas have not been sufficiently fleshed out and discussed that would make them ready at this time as recommendations. The committee is operating autonomously from the oversight of any person, any agency, or organization. The individuals comprising this committee are excellent cross-section of criminal justice and child welfare professionals. Each has very strong commitments to ethics, integrity, and candor. One of my early statements to the committee was that we would review the materials and other information objectively, reach our conclusions and recommendations, and, quote, let the chips fall where they may. We are proceeding as expeditiously as we can, but we are also being very thorough in our review. The cross-section of committee members has also been invaluable in our discussions in the identification of issues, seeing them from differing perspectives. I firmly believe that any single discipline or profession, professional expertise alone would not be able to grasp the multiplicity of factors, the collective solutions and alternatives, the melding of opinions, or reach the conclusions and recommendations in a holistic approach.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Senator Carter. Bob, it's so good to see you, and Phil, thank you. My concern is that in the makeup of the employees chief, that one group that I think is absolutely missing, that is a foster parent. Because even though the chief and all the other people, the lawyers and the representatives of children, I don't think they know like foster parents. I think foster parents have a perspective that is unbelievable in terms of the clustering or the non-commitment or the keeping of information. And so I would like to see you guys think about that piece as a member at large or something of that nature. I do think that they're totally absent from the table and they know more than any of the other people that are outside of them.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you very much. The committee appreciates the opportunity to provide you with the interim status report of our work. I will assure you that the final report will be comprehensive in our findings and recommendations, and I would be happy to answer any questions this committee may have.
Thank you very much, Chief. We will have several questions. I'd like to do a little shifting of seating and ask Ms. McFarland if she would exchange places with Mr. Jester so that we have your representation right in front of us. Okay.
Chair Gordley, members of the committee, Senator Carter and Senator Burdick, my name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I am a member of the review committee, which I serve on as a volunteer, as do most of the other members of that committee. And I am a foster parent, and I have been a foster parent for DHS for 9 years. I've never served as an OYA foster parent, but I think I have a fair amount of insight into the perspective of foster parents, and I do try to bring that to this committee work here. My background in terms of contact with OYA is that our office represents several hundred youth a year who are committed to OYA. I also supervise our helpline, which is often accessed by youth who are in the juvenile correctional facilities, who have complaints about those facilities. So I am already involved in issues of complaint and working with OYA on resolving those issues. And in the past, I was the lead counsel on the Gary H. versus Hegstrom federal court litigation, which went on for 12 years and which addressed the conditions of confinement at the McLaren Training School.
Thank you for that background. What I would like to do is go to page 4 of the preliminary report, Chief Brown, and to the section that's titled Provisional Recommendations. And if you could walk us through each of those recommendations, if you will.
Madam Chair,
with the commentary leading to why you made that why you're making each of the recommendations.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. The first recommendation that we make is the development of an improved hiring practice that requires supplemental testing to the general employment application used by the State of Oregon, a thorough and professional background investigation, and a post-employment offer psychological examination of all employees who have contact with youth as part of their job duties. In the examination of the everything that occurred in the Michael Boyles and the Lyman Foster Home incident, one of the areas that we went back and looked at was how did a person that might have committed these offenses gotten into this position in the first place. Admittedly, any position that or job that has ready access to youth is a target environment for pedophiles, and they will try to obtain work in these areas. The juvenile parole and probation officer, because that individual has a tremendous amount of authority over the supervision of youth under the supervision of the youth authority, is a prime example of where a pedophile might want to work. We ask ourselves, how did a person like this get into this position? We go back completely to the beginning of the starting process of the application, the screening, the hiring practices, what tests were used, and were there any psychological examinations used to determine the fitness or if there were any existing psychopathologies that should have excluded that person from that position. In this instance, we found, now this is going back prior to the Oregon Youth Authority, to the days of DHS. The hiring practice in that at that time was the submission of a state application in which your qualifications were determined by answering three questions, rather benign questions at that. The supervisor would call the three previous employers and ask them how this employee performed at those locations. There would be a criminal history check done through the state and national NCIC to determine if the person had any arrests on their records. And short of that, they were then given a job, at which time they were fingerprinted, and their fingerprints are run through the automated fingerprint identification system with the FBI. That is the totality of the hiring process. As such, there is no supplemental background history information that was asked. There was no family, friends, relatives, or anyone else contacted, for that matter, to determine what this person was like outside of their work environment. The telephonic interviews of the prior employers generally is insufficient to extract the information necessary without going there, looking at their personnel files and any discipline or other actions in the performance appraisals that they had in those positions. The psychological examination is one that is becoming increasingly used in many public positions, particularly in law enforcement, in determining specific dimensions for a given job. You cannot take one psychological examination, say, for California Youth Authority and apply it to the Oregon Youth Authority. There are different organizations. They have different cultures, different duties and jobs, even though they perform similar work. The study has to be done specifically on the organization to determine what kind of an individual is this organization looking for, what kind of an individual has a personality that best fits for this work, and then additional dimensions through testing and clinical interviews that will determine if that person has any psychopathologies such as violence, pedophilia, dishonesty, untruthfulness, and through that testing process you can exclude potential candidates who do not either meet that profile, that fitness for duty, or have those dimensions that are undesirable for that position. The second recommendation was to increase the training for the Oregon Youth Authority to enhance the knowledge, skills,
Chief,
and...
Chief Brown.
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me, please. Senator Devlin has a question for you.
Yes. Chief Brown, one question that I had is, in looking at OIA, did the committee look at any differences in terms of selection of institutional personnel versus probation and parole personnel versus parties that are not actually probably classified as employed, but selection of foster parents? Because it appears to me that there are differences in all of these areas, and I wonder to what extent the committee looked at some of those differences. I mean, they work in entirely different environments.
The Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the process for employees, those that are full-time paid employees of the state of Oregon, are generally similar across the board. They include interviews and the application process in that. Foster parents is a different process in that someone wanting to become a foster parent will contact the agency, make their interests known. They will go through home visits and interviews and a series of processes to determine whether there's anything there that would disqualify them. Saving that there isn't, then they can be certified as a foster parent. I'd like to defer here for 1 minute to see if I missed anything from Julie McFarland.
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, that's correct, and we are not particularly focusing on institutional staff since this case did not involve and institutional staff, and there really is a difference in terms of qualifications there. But we are reviewing the certification process, and that was used, and what certification process should be used in the future, and hiring supervision and firing for parole officer staff.
So you're specifically looking at that area, but you'd still be recognizing that although the circumstances may not, say carefully here, may not have risen to this much attention, but there have been cases, I think if you look at any state system that deals with juveniles in institutional settings, there have been cases of questionable conduct. And that's not in any way to criticize the vast majority of personnel that work in those environments who act appropriately and do their job in an exemplary manner.
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, absolutely correct, and I think that we fully expect that recommendations that we make as to staff in the community who are supervising parolees will probably also be extended to correctional facility staff.
Thank you.
Chief Brown, before you go into the second item, and again, just to put your comments into context, context which you have provided for us, I'm looking at the language on page 4 in the section titled Provisional Recommendations, and what you are telling us is that the committee believes there were several stages of breakdown in the processes of the Children's Services Division and then on to the Oregon Youth Authority. The committee believes that had some or all of these recommendations been in place, they may have prevented the crimes allegedly committed by Michael Boyles and the unacceptable conditions at the Lyman Foster Home. And then, again, you go on to say that the recommendations you are providing are being provided in the order of chronology of events. So, again, just to provide context, we're talking about processes that broke down, that led to terrible and tragic consequences.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And when chronology, it's not necessarily a time chronology as it is a step chronology of a person being applying for and being hired into the system.
Very good. Very good.
Madam Chair?
Senator Carter?
On that comment, Chief, I was wondering, as I looked at... since you're talking about time and chronology, and looking at this report, the external review,
yes,
on page 1 where you talk about OIA policies number 4, you speak to early warning systems. And when you do early warning systems, and if in between the early warning system and whatever happens next, if somebody reports unacceptable behavior because it hasn't become a crime or anything at this point, but a foster parent or a grandparent or a kid report unacceptable behavior, what happens?
The early Madam Chair, Senator, the early warning system takes several different forms. It can be the report of an incident which should rise to the suspicion to initiate an inquiry.
Okay.
And I address that, I believe, in number 3 of our recommendations. A second portion of an early warning system is other employees and supervisory personnel that work closely with any individual employee to recognize symptoms, conditions, actions, behavior that would indicate something amiss is occurring. A classic example in this particular situation would have been the recognition of grooming behavior, or what appeared to be grooming behavior, by Michael Boyles of some of the youth under his care. That grooming behavior typically, if you are trained to recognize it, would be a signal or a threshold that would cause a supervisor to make inquiry, what's going on here?
Are all supervisors mandated reporters?
Yes, ma'am, they are.
So what happens when mandated reporters do not follow through, go to the next step?
May I defer that to Deputy Director Levin, please?
Thank you.
And before you respond, I think some of what Senator Carter is trying to get at is going to come out in the number two
okay,
on
I'll
page
wait.
Five.
Okay, I'll
and the
wait.
Committee's work around those issues.
Absolutely.
Okay. If you could respond briefly.
Thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Well, I don't mind waiting, Madam Chair.
Okay. Please go forward.
Was there further questions on the first recommendation? Going on to the second recommendation was the increase in training for the Oregon Youth Authority to enhance the knowledge, skills, and abilities and measure comprehension of entry-level supervisory personnel and above. This recommendation is predicated upon a review of the training that is being provided to entry-level personnel of the Youth Authority, irrespective of what level, if it is line level all the way up through management, what training they receive when they enter the service that would enable them to perform or have the knowledge, skills, and abilities to perform their duties. It is required within the first 12 months. Generally, it is early in their career or position with the Oregon Youth Authority, but not necessarily required. The 36 hours is a broad introductory curriculum that introduces the new employee to the organization and some specifics of what their job duties are. However, it is in my opinion that given the duties and responsibilities, particularly of the juvenile parole and probation officers in the field, having authority to remove some constitutional rights of a youth, such as their freedom by taking them into temporary custody, or any searches that they may have of those and the resultant Fourth Amendment effects of that, that there should be extensive training, further training of the juvenile parole and probation officers in preparing them and understanding what the legal requirements are, the case laws that accompany those decisions, and some demonstrated performance and competency in understanding that information.
Chief, part of what you're telling us is that the current training is inadequate?
In my opinion, Madam Chair, yes, ma'am.
And you are also saying, again, I'm looking at the language in your report on page six, that through interviews and review of training documents, it appears supervisory and management personnel are promoted or hired into their positions before they are suitably trained to assume those duties?
In some cases, that is true, Madam Chair, yes.
Was that the case, was that a factor in how Mr. Boyles was supervised?
Madam Chair, I have not been able to review that particular training record yet of the supervisors of Michael Boyle, so I cannot comment for sure on that particular instance. If I may add, this is not an uncommon practice in most governmental agencies, in that employees seeking higher levels of authority and responsibility, when a position becomes available, they apply for it. They have done an exceptional job in what their current assignment is, and they're promoted to the next level. Yet there was not the preparatory steps there getting them ready to assume that. It is my opinion that if you're going to assume a new role, you should be qualified to do so before you are appointed to it, not be appointed to it and then learn how to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is extremely common in most governmental entities. It is not this particular one is systemic in most governments.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You mentioned a couple minutes ago, which has been one of my concerns all along, looking at this issue along with everyone else with 2020 hindsight, being much easier to see problems after they've occurred rather than when you're going through them. But you mentioned the whole notion of grooming behavior. And I think it was very clear just from reading news accounts that that kind of behavior was going on. But I look at this training section, and I see about training supervisors and the employees themselves, but I don't see any reference to training people to recognize the kinds of things at an early stage in this section. Now, did you have a discussion of that, or perhaps I'm missing it elsewhere in the report?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, we are looking at that one very closely. In addressing my recommendations here, while they are initial and provisional, I spoke in a broader brush, if you will. And in the final report, we will get down to absolute specifics of what that particular training should include. Other examples include individuals assigned in the eastern part of the state, say around Native American tribes, and that face somewhat different conditions than juvenile parole and probation officers assigned in the Portland, Salem, or Eugene metropolitan areas. Where there isn't gangs there, there are gangs here. That's the kind of difference in training that makes it area-specific in some cases, but yet other topics are universal and applicable to everybody. Universal mandatory reporting requirements, as an example. So what I'm suggesting that will come out in the final report is more specifics of what belongs where, and the grooming behavior should be recognizable by line-level employees, the JPPOs themselves, as well as supervisors, as well as managers, as well as foster parents. They should be able to recognize that as a warning system or a red flag going up saying that we need to take a closer look at this. Something's going on.
And it would also be helpful, I would think, Madam Chair, if I can follow up, it would also be helpful to have some kind of a neutral clearinghouse for those kinds of, you know, suspicion. Because these are not specific things. These are not things that you can say, well, I saw the person hit the child. That's a mandatory report. Grooming is different. It's much more subtle. And there needs to be, it would seem to me, a clearinghouse where someone could go and have the full attention of someone, and where people throughout the agency, not just supervisors, but line people as well, secretaries, anyone would have access to this clearinghouse, and then you would get kind of a pattern on some people. Did any kind of discussion along those lines occur?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I think I'll be addressing those in recommendations 3 and 4.
Okay, great. We'll wait for that then.
Thank you. Please continue.
Additionally, I think I've addressed the line-level personnel, the necessary for the training, as well as the supervisory training, and I'd be glad to answer any questions relative to this recommendation.
Please continue.
The third recommendation is the creation of an office within the Oregon Youth Authority whose responsibility it is to receive and investigate all complaints against the agency or any employee of the agency. We have an agency here with well over 1,000 employees, and with the type of work that is being performed, it is a rich environment, a target, if you will, for complaints to be lodged, both erroneous, frivolous complaints are regularly lodged, as well as more serious ones, such as occurred in this particular instance here. There should be a policy that clearly specifies how complaints are to be handled. They may be handled informally at a supervisory level for minor incidents in which clarification of policy practice customs may resolve the matter with the complaining party, to where it may be a joint investigation of the supervisor and an entity that with an office within the Oregon Youth Authority that is specially trained for the conduct of internal investigations, and then for more serious events, this office here would conduct those investigations themselves. Now, I want to clarify that what we are proposing here is not in place of the Oregon State Police conducting criminal investigations. The personnel of the Oregon Youth Authority, as well as this position here under number three, would not have peace officer powers. So any criminal events that may occur would still have to be referred to the Oregon State Police for investigation. But we are suggesting that there be a parallel internal investigation, even if a criminal case is being taken care of, a parallel internal investigation into what occurred for the violation of policies, rules, code of conduct, regulations, and employment actions taken from that investigation.
Chief, in the aftermath of the Boyles case, what are your early findings about a system of reporting currently in place? What's in place now? What does that look like?
Madam Chair, the policies for mandatory reporting of these occurrences is indeed in place, and it's a good policy. What we feel may have been lacking here is a process and understanding and a recognition of what was going on. Through the interviews that I conducted, as an example, taking the mindset of a restorative justice side, the juvenile parole and probation officer is more on the juvenile justice side versus a child welfare worker who looks at youth as victims and needing help and shelter and all of these things. In this situation here, you had some employees from the child welfare system that became employees of the Oregon Youth Authority, bringing with them the same perceptions and of youth and what has occurred out there. And when they see a juvenile parole officer fighting extraordinarily hard to get a youth under their supervision some extra privilege or clothing or whatever, it would appear that from the child welfare side that person is doing an extraordinary job. From the juvenile or the justice restorative side, it would appear that it's grooming behavior. And that's what I'm trying to say, is there's differing perceptions in there depending on whose eyes you're looking at it from. And bringing some of those individuals over, Michael Boyles was a social service specialist at child welfare, and it would be natural that it would appear that that's what he should be doing rather than the restorative justice. But that did, in my opinion, have some complicating factors in what occurred or how it was reviewed and why perhaps some of those early red flags were not recognized.
Thank you very much. This really goes to items 2 and 3, where you're talking about the training and the reporting. Was there any discussion, and believe me, I know this is probably a bramble pit, but was there any discussion to extending any of the training and reporting access and processes to the youth themselves? Because I think that's one of the things that came out of this case is the youth himself was very reluctant, very frightened to say anything. And you even have to wonder whether the youth have been told what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and to be trained themselves, like we increasingly train children in public schools, you know, good touch, bad touch, that type of thing, obviously at a different level. But to let youth know that they are there for a reason, but there are lines that they can expect not to be crossed. And if they are not crossed, that they do have options, non-threatening options, to report it. Was there any discussion of that sort?
If I could respond to that, Chair Gordley, Senator Burdick. We did look at standards for training, and we didn't feel that we were to the point yet to make specific recommendations. But, for instance, we looked at the American Bar Association standards, which do require significantly more training than what is currently provided in OIA with, I believe, 80 hours of initial training.
Of the employees?
Of employees. Mm-hmm. And one of the recommendations of the ABA standards was to provide that kind of information to youth as well. I know that youth who are entering the training schools do get some information about that, and that's something we can look at. But I don't think that youth who are just coming into the parole system or on probation under OIA are necessarily getting that. And that is also our organization has booklets that we hand out to children in foster care that talk to children in foster care about, you know, what is okay and what is not okay for their treatment addressed at different age levels. And so those could easily be adapted for use in that kind of setting.
Senator Carter, I want to make sure that the issue that you raised earlier is being addressed in the responses that you're hearing back from Chief Brown and Ms. McFarland.
Thank you, Chair Gordley. I think it's so subjective, and how do we my constituent foster parents were sanctioned because they reported. The young men were too afraid to talk. And when the police, and I'm setting the scenario up so you can kind of hear what my concerns are, and then you guys tell us, you know, whether it's a part of your training. And then when the state police investigated my constituent and got through with the whole situation, there were no findings for them to go any further. Yet there were 10 years out here someplace that there was knowledge about this guy. How do we make everybody at every level accountable? And how do we keep the foster parents who had quit their jobs to keep kids, in my district in particular, from being sanctioned? I mean, are you guys hearing me? I don't know how you address this, and how do you put your arm around this and make sure that that is taken into consideration when you're talking about training? Because even until this day, until Bob came along, they were still being sanctioned, and they are not feeling that pressure anymore now.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, it is a portion of the training in that the training should deliver what the a clear expectation of what the employee's responsibilities are, what the supervisor's responsibilities are, and a section that deals with the accountability, holding individuals accountable for not taking action on these issues. It can be said in a policy, but unless it is trained upon and routinely reinforced over and over and over again, it becomes a lax system. And again, it is not something isolated to the Oregon Youth Authority. It is a systemic problem in most governmental organizations. Mm-hmm. And that supervisors, they manage things. They do not supervise people. Supervision of people is a person business. Managing is a thing business. And they're too engrossed in dealing with things and numbers and caseloads and not enough attention on the supervision of a person and knowing what that person is doing day in, day out, how they're doing and what they're doing. There's where the accountability comes from.
So your training, Madam Chair, Chief, will kind of ferret that out, and so that people will watch in supervising people will have more ideas about how you, when they see those red flags, because that's what I see. Nobody saw the flags, and when people heard about it, nobody wanted to do anything about it. A whole system of government shielded this guy for 10 years, and other people who brought it forth, they were sanctioned for it. So how do you make sure the system responds in kind and don't sanction the person, you know, who gives them the information?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I believe that the investigatory process of complaints needs to be totally transparent, totally open, and very aggressive, not being headhunters, if you will.
Right, I agree.
Being very fair and just in all of their actions, but still it should be the policy of any agency that you do look at every complaint that is made against the organization or any of its employees and determine the validity of that complaint. And one of my other recommendations that I believe is going to be made is that annually the director should be given a report of every complaint that has been made during the previous year. That report should analyze and identify what areas were complained in, how many of them were sustained, not sustained, exonerated, or unfounded. The analysis should include why those complaints occurred, and it will be an invaluable tool for the director in identifying problem employee, training issues, policy failures, or reorganization that needs to be made to ensure or minimize these complaints ever occur again.
Bingo.
And you say in your report, Chief, that, again, I'm looking at page 6, item 3, external issues such as complaints are not always given sufficient attention or weight and fall through the cracks. That may very well have been the case of Michael Boyles. Certainly it was the case. That's my editorial comment. But you also go on to say further that conducting an internal investigation is a task best suited to an experienced investigator who has specific training in the conduct of this kind of inquiry. And you say further that all complaints, including minor complaints that can be handled immediately by a supervisor, should be investigated. The individuals charged with overseeing the responsibility should be advised of all complaints, founded or unfounded. Well, we know, you know, hindsight looking back, it didn't work. So looking today at what is your take on what's currently in place? Is there you're making recommendations about processes, policies, procedures that need to be established, but what is your information to us today about what is currently in place? What are employees doing now? How are they reporting now on situations that may be arising?
Madam Chair, I think that without sounding like I'm patronizing here, I think there have been incredible forward progress made since Director Jester has taken his position. We have seen in a number of areas things that we were considering based upon what was at one time recommendations that we were going to make, only to find out that the Oregon Youth Authority had proactively already identified those and taken them forward. And I believe that is also the case with the investigation of complaints. It is a recognition of what has occurred and that things must indeed change. I don't think, even though we have made great strides forward, I think there are still more that can be clarified in the policy and the process, and that will be included in our final report.
If I could respond to that as well, Chair Gordley, the agency has gone forward with the mandatory abuse training for mandatory reporter training for the staff and has accomplished that in a very short period of time. And I think, you know, we'll be making some recommendations about that. We'll also be looking at the issue of empowering foster parents and making sure that they have access to someone to make complaints about. I think that this case will be a learning case for people who are training staff about mandatory reporters. They will be able to find out that, you know, in this case, Mr. Boyles did suppress the complaints from foster parents, that he did even, you know, get his supervisor to sign off on his recommendation that they not be allowed contact with one of these children. He went to court and tried to engage the juvenile court in that. He was really an insidious fellow, and I think that this is going to be kind of a classic case that hopefully will be used to train about what to look for, and I think many people were just simply duped by him. But hopefully we will be able to use it as a good learning and training experience.
Very good. Please continue.
Were there, Madam Chair, were there any other questions on recommendation three? Moving on to four. The recommendation is to create an Office of Ombudsman external to the Oregon Youth Authority that provides additional avenues of access for complaints and serves as a, quote, inspector general or auditor to assess the handling and resolution of complaints. As noted in the first sentence there, this position is akin to an ambassador on one hand and a quality assurance mechanism on the other. There were comments made earlier that there needs to be some mechanism in place in which youth or foster parents or citizens or relatives feel comfortable going to a given position, an identifiable position, to make complaints, knowing that the complaint will be taken seriously and handled adequately, and there will be no repercussions or sanctions, if you will, against the person making that. The ombudsman position would do exactly that. Internally within the organization, there is the position that is described in number three, the last recommendation that a person could go to make a complaint, and a process in place internally. Mm-hmm. However, if an individual is not comfortable in making that internal complaint, the external ombudsman is the appropriate place for that complaint to be made. But in addition to simply being the ambassador between the public and a governmental entity, that position can also serve as a quality assurance in the oversight or review of the handling of all complaints, internal or external, to the organization. It can do the quality assurance of the exit interviews. Exit interviews, by the way, are being done by Youth Authority and are being increased. But this position here, being separate, apart, autonomous, may very likely be a better place for that information to be lodged, because people would feel more open to discussing any issues that they might have.
And the committee's recommendation is that the position report directly to the governor.
Senator Burley, yes. That makes it external, and we felt that that was the appropriate place in the structure for it to be.
Additional questions or comments on provisional recommendation number four? Moving on to number five.
Madam Chair, number five entails policy review. The Youth Authority, one of our committee members said it very succinctly, that the Youth Authority was created in a broadcloth of the predecessor Children's Services Division, and we believe a lot of those policies came across with the creation of the new organization, and they were within one at one time. In looking at the policies that we have reviewed thus far, many of them are reactive in nature, in that a policy is created after something has occurred and the writing is, well, this shouldn't have happened, but there's nothing in there to have prevented it, so we need to create it. And the other comment is there are policies, but the processes to implement, execute those policies is not as sufficient as it should be. Our recommendation here is to do a thorough review of the organization's policies, whether it be internal with assistance from outside or the retaining of an outside organization such as the National Institute of Corrections or whoever, to assist in that policy review. To put it succinctly, it should have an identification of what policies there needs to be, what the philosophical statements of those areas are, and then a process or procedure that clearly defines a guideline to the employees on how to execute that policy. Questions?
Just an observation that the Oregon Youth Authority is an agency, organization, institution that is a decade, has a decade of experience, and that 10 years into the experience, we're talking about the need for developing policy manual. A policy manual for the agency is just deeply, deeply troubling. Most certainly this is work that needs to go forward, but it just makes me wonder how our approach became so fragmented. And maybe it does go back to the beginning and the statement that's in your document that OYA was created kind of whole cloth from CSD. As I recall, being around 10 years ago, we didn't give OYA an adequate investment of resources either. I'm talking dollars here. So it just, it's just troubling that this is where we find ourselves. But we can, the challenge is to do everything required to put the agency on solid footing, not just in terms of policies and procedures, but in every way possible. Most certainly, in ways that ensure the protection of children who are in the charge of the OYA.
Madam Chair, a few minutes ago I made the comment that the topic at that time was not necessarily specific to the Oregon Youth Authority. It is rather common in governments, and in the last 4 years I've had at least six agencies, law enforcement agencies in the state, come to me asking for assistance with their policies, and I ask them, let me see what you have. They said, no, we need assistance having policies. Well, let me see what you have. They said, we don't have any. And there was not one written word of policy, procedure, conduct, or anything. So, again, it's not unique. Now, the Oregon Youth Authority does indeed have a pretty substantial and thorough set of policies, and policy writing is not a simple matter to do. It is a complex organization of words that creates the philosophical position of the director and then a mechanism by which the employees can execute that philosophy. It's difficult to write. It is dynamic. It changes day by day. I'm also associated with a company, a corporation in California, and we put out up to 80 revisions to the policies annually. That is how fast policies can change, predicated on the case law, legislative changes, technologies, community mores, in this case statewide mores. Changes, those are dynamic documents that change readily, and you have to stay right on top of them, and it's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Are there additional, I have some recommendations for how we move forward. Thank you, Senator Devlin. But before I get to those couple of recommendations coming from the chair, I want to make sure that I hear all of the questions and concerns of Senator Walker, Senator Burdick on the record regarding this matter.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of stunned at the moment to learn that a state agency responsible for taking care of our children doesn't have a policy manual. My office has a office resource manual that I had my staff put together the very first session I came into the legislature, so that
Senator Walker,
somebody was gone.
Just to interrupt for a moment,
yeah.
I think it is inaccurate to say that there is no policy and procedure manual. There is such in place. What we're talking about is the quality and the content.
Quality.
What
does exist?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker. Let me say it again. The Oregon Youth Authority does have a policy manual. It has a fairly extensive policy manual. What we are saying is that there needs to be modifications to that manual that ensures that it is dynamic, that it is updated regularly, and that the policy section of it articulates the philosophy and direction of the director, and that the procedures within it demonstrate to employees how to execute that philosophy.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you for that clarification. Mr. Brown, certainly, because, like I said, I put one together when I first came in the legislature, because if someone's absent or sick, you know, when I had my staff was all sick one day, and I didn't even know the password to get into my own computer in the outer office, then that was ridiculous. So you're right. Those policies need to be flexible. They're not static. They have to change. How often, can you tell me in your review, how often you found that they were reviewing their policy manual?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I have not reviewed that particular information, so I'm unable to respond to it at this time. I know that the Oregon Youth Authority does have a full-time staff person who is the policy writer, and so I'm speculating here, but I would imagine that that person works full-time on the manual. But again, it's a matter of having the processes clearly defined to execute the policies.
Senator Walker, did you wish to continue?
Well, I just one other question. Madam Chair, Mr. Brown, it sounds like you have extensive experience in policy manual issues. So are there other members on the committee that have that same experience that you can draw from, or how are you going to make those recommendations?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the recommendations that we are going to make relative to the policies will be sufficient for the director and deputy director to attain assistance to clarify what policies they do have. Again, they do have a full-time policy writer, but what we are suggesting is some outside objectivity in looking at it. It's the forest in the trees thing, if you will.
All right, that's helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And colleagues, we have about a half hour left for this meeting. We have another committee coming into hearing room F at 3 o'clock. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the most interesting and thought-provoking things I've heard today is your description of the two cultures that form this agency, the human services culture and the corrections culture, and where some behavior might be very appropriate for one, it would the other side would definitely look askance. I think that is really an area where, when you look at your policy manual, to just take that one on head on, where, you know, this is our culture, and this is where we came from, these two different cultures, and this is what it means today. And so to really take that issue head on, because when you said that, it just struck me. For the first time, I started to understand why some of this behavior that I saw as raising a red flag in a corrections culture, why some of this behavior could have gone on in the first place. So I just, that was a nugget that I think came out today that I would really like to see addressed straight on, as, you know, here's where we came from, and here's what we are today, and these are the expectations.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, two aspects to that. First is that it's somewhat being addressed in that the longer the two different cultures are together, the closer they meld into one. Secondly, there's an attrition factor always that the OYA has been in existence for 10 years already. If a person first came into the OYA at the beginning, they're already over a third of the way through their career. The second part, I always lose my thought, and I should write these down because it was a really good thought.
Believe me, we all know where
I'll think. Come back. I did the same thing this morning. I'll come back to it in a minute. I'll remember what it was.
Or
I'm sorry.
Come back to you at 3 a.m.
Don't call.
I will remember it, though. Oh, I'm sorry. That was a response, and when I come up with my brain lapse, I'll...
Mm-hmm.
I'll bring it up.
Senator Burdick, are you ready to move on?
I'm anxious to hear your recommendation.
All right. I want to acknowledge that Senator Winters has arrived, and thank her for being here. Thank her very much for putting on record some time ago a set of questions that gave the department, gave the agency, the Oregon Youth Authority, direction in moving this investigation forward with an eye toward transparency. And again, thank you for your initiative and your work, and want to give you the opportunity to raise any questions or make comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I had a previous meeting and had advised the chair that I would be a little late in getting here, and I did meet with the OYA yesterday, and we had quite an in-depth conversation on particularly the assurance that what we have begun here today in the investigation and the transparency, that it doesn't stop here. Mm-hmm. My concern that I shared yesterday is twofold. One is to assure that systems are in place not only with OYA, but with DHS and the whole as well, because you also have the need to make certain that the certification and background checks are occurring in both areas, not just the one. If you begin to look at what had occurred in, before OYA became an agency, a standalone agency, that you had the two combined cultures, which we found wasn't really conducive the children and families a lot of years ago, and I won't go back in all that history. But also, we talked about, and I'm glad to see the recommendation of the Office of the Ombudsman, and I want to expand on that because those of you who know me know that since I returned to this building in 99, I have believed that there needed to be a place that was independent, that you could have to go to file your complaint as a citizen of this state. We do not have that. We have ombudsman, and of course my other good senator down understands the position well. I think the absence of that position, whether it was for OYA or in the old days we called it the correctional ombudsman, if I recall, but where you were able to have an independent look at issues, which is outside of the agency, and I really believe that anything that this body does, that we need to go back there. You need to have whether it's Inspector General, whether it is the Ombudsman, that is detached from the very agency that the complaint is being registered against, that they are able to take a look at what really is going on. I think had that been a process with this case where you had someone else having to look at it, you would have then had the governor who would have access to that information, as well as probably this body early on. But because we no longer have that kind of a structure in place, even as legislators, we are not getting in a timely way information that we could then address early on before it has allowed to set and become, as I call it, a part of the climate of the agency itself. So I really like the recommendation and support it, not only in this particular arena, but in others of state government as well.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Winters, for those comments.
Madam Chair, can I make another comment? Because I'd have to say, and I want to thank the agency, and I want to thank its director for also being very forthright. Our conversation was very open, and there is a real need for the transparency, and I know sometimes how difficult that can be, because the other thing when we look at transparency is that the agencies also have to look at this other potential out there that talks lawsuits and all this other stuff. We've built a climate in our society where that piece hangs there too, and I just want to thank you for the transparency that you have brought forth in your investigation on this, recognizing that the chips are going to fall later where they may. But that's also with state government as well as other governments that continually to hang there when they're looking at how much they're willing to share. And there again goes back to this whole issue of whether or not we've got an independent kind of a body that can begin to take this kind of information where you don't have those kinds of threats looming over, if you will. So, but I want to thank you for your transparency.
And I join Senator Winters in those comments because Mr. Jester and Mr. Lemon have continued to seek guidance, direction, and you're right, Senator Winters. The conversations have been, they've been very difficult, but they've also been very forthright. suggested next steps for the agency as we move forward. I have four items I want to put before you and also before the Prevention Review Committee. One, I'm asking that the agency price the preliminary recommendations that you agree with now and which have a fiscal impact. The thought being that if you do this over the next few days, and I ask you to do this over the next few days, these could be items considered for funding in the final budget reconciliations. And I have already spoken to the Senate Budget Chair Schrader about this being an area of priority. So that's one recommendation. Second, I will request from the co-chairs that they consider a budget note for the agency to report to the Interim Judiciary Committee and the Emergency Board with the final report and an implementation plan. And I will ask the agency to advise of what would be the appropriate due date. And then, in addition, asking the agency to send a final report to legislative leadership, to Budget Committee and Judiciary Committee members, and then that would allow for time for discussion of any follow-up that needed to occur. Lastly, and my statement comes as a result of a conversation with Senator Winters, and she may wish to speak to this. If there are continuing concerns regarding the independence or depth of the review that is currently underway, there may be the opportunity to ask the governor's office for another more independent review and report, or the Department of Justice, leaving the opening for that to occur, again, depending on the independence of and depth of the review of the committee's work currently underway. Do you need additional clarity on either of those, any of those four points?
Madam Chair.
Senator Carter.
In listening to your reviews, I want to give further kudos to Bob Jester for doing something about the employees, and I use this word, it might sound a little harsh, but who were basically in cahoots. And I would like for him to continue to have the courage to get rid of other people who were knowingly a part of this negligent act over that period of time. I just got another call today from a couple of my constituents. So it still is very far-reaching. Mm-hmm. So I'd like for him to continue to have the courage to get those people, clear those people out of the system that sanctioned people when they were telling about what was happening.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Courage is a very appropriate word. Courageous leadership is absolutely required, and I'm confident that we have that as well in Mr. Jester.
Madam Chair, since I And I thank you for requesting the carrying forward the results of the independent review and whether or not further look by the governor's office or AG's office is required. But in addition, since we have the good chair here from the Human Services Committee, and since I also believe that there is a correlation with Human Services, is perhaps as we look at budget notes, particularly to look at whether or not those standards are also in place, because I think it's important that as we talk about, you know, some of the problem that occurred here occurred when they were in Children's Services Division and whether or not that agency is following the kind of certification protocol to make certain the background checks are. Mm-hmm. So I would like to, you know, that we meet with the other good chair to carry the budget note forward into that particular agency as well. This is too important of an issue of where we have trusted our children that we have responsibility for as a state, and then we find that they are being further abused by individuals that we have thought would take good care of them. And so we have it in not only OYA, but we have it in the Human Service Agency as well.
Madam Chair, since we are communicating and our LFO staff is here for both committees, Ms. Baker, I would like for us to look at other caseworkers to see if the certification standards are will be in keeping with the standards that were mentioned here today. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Ms. Baker for her work in preparation for this meeting, including preparation of language for the four options recommendations I've put forward to the agency. Thank you very much. Any closing comments from Chief Brown, Ms. McFarland?
Madam Chair and committee, initially when we began looking at some of the issues surrounding this incident as well as the potential for others, it seemed to be a almost overwhelming amount of information that we had to review. And again, I wanted to recognize the efforts that the Oregon Youth Authority has already made in taking tremendous strides forward. And that has been recognized to me personally by staff within the organization as well as those outside. Issues that we would have been recommending or working on, only to find out that they're already being worked on or have been implemented. So things are moving forward, and things are getting done. So we're very appreciative of those efforts.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Senator Gordley, members, I appreciate your commitment to this issue. I think it's very important. I think that having the legislative oversight will help assure that we're going to accomplish what we've set out to do with reviewing this matter. And I look at other states that I'm familiar with where issues like this end up in litigation and only come to legislators after protracted litigation, and I think that this is a much better approach.
Madam Chair, if I could just make one comment. Ms. McFarlane mentioned the mandatory reporting that's been discussed earlier, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to reiterate with her that we have had this similar discussion on Senate Bill 372 in the Judiciary Committee, and remain ever vigilant to make sure that all of our mandatory reporters get the kind of training that they're supposed to have. And as she's, Mr. Farling and Mr. Travis are working with me currently on a proposal to the Oregon Law Commission to review those statutes and see what we can do about them. And I'm also trying to get some budget reports in some of these other agencies to develop performance standards so they all come back and tell us how they're meeting this requirement under the law, and this is a clear example of why we need that. Wouldn't you agree, Ms. McFarlane?
Chair Gordley, Senator Walker, I would certainly agree, and I think it's actually one of the difficult tests that our review committee has, which is to look at the interaction of these reports as they're reported to DHS under the mandatory reporting laws, and how much of that investigation then gets kicked back, or responsibility for those calls gets kicked back to OIA, which is pretty much what's happening now. So we need to take a look at that, and it'll be a challenge for us.
Again, thank you both for your service to this committee to date, and for the work that you will be doing into the future. We appreciate your efforts very much. Thank you all. And committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you.